Hi, everyone, and welcome to First State Insights, a podcast presented by the University of Delaware's Institute for Public Administration. That's IPA for short. My name is Troy Mix. I'm Associate Director at IPA and your host for this episode. Let's start with a simple question. How should small organizations with limited budgets tell their stories and get their work noticed? If you work at a small organization, you likely know there's no simple response to this question. Communication can be a challenge, period. But what if I told you there's a way to tell your organization's story on a $0 budget? That's the premise of DIY Public Relations, a new book by Dan Shortridge, a communications and marketing consultant and author with more than 20 years of experience in the trenches of local public relations and daily journalism. For this episode, I spoke with Dan on October 6, 2022, about how organizations of all sizes can start telling their stories and spreading the word. Let's get to the conversation. Dan, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Troy. Good to be here.
Wanted to talk about your new book, DIY Public Relations. And I guess my first question is, who's your audience?
Sure. The audience is really anybody who wants to get the word out in the local media, anybody who needs attention or wants media coverage for an issue or an event or program. People I had in mind when I was writing it were local nonprofit executives, government officials, and small businesses, school leaders as well. Yeah, anyone who doesn't have a communication staff or anyone who has a communications person who maybe is just starting out in the field.
I guess I'm going to ask, what gives you the right to author such a book? How do you kind of empathize with, or how did you live the experience of those groups you just talked about?
Sure. I've been working in local public relations for about the last 10 years. And before that, I was in local journalism for 10 years. So I've spent the last 20 plus years in and around the local media. My focus isn't on getting coverage in the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or getting people on CNN. That would be nice, but those outlets are not the ones that reach the core audience that I'm trying to go after there. I primarily work for state government, but that's involved a lot of support and coaching for local businesses and nonprofits as well, a lot of partnerships on news and events. And that's involved everyone from community farmers markets to Purdue Farms, from Habitat for Humanity chapters to large affordable housing developers. I've also had articles published in B2B publications and state media on communications, marketing, social media research, things like that. But above all, Troy, I'm a big believer in doing things yourself. I don't think you always need an expensive consultant, and you certainly don't need to spend money on a big media database or big software program to be able to do it yourself.
And in terms of, you were talking about CNN, New York Times not typically being the core audience for a lot of the groups that you're aiming this book at and a lot of the organizations you've worked for. I guess in the Delaware context and maybe, you know, Delmarva, but more broadly, what type of outlets are we talking about that you think these organizations need to reach or they want to reach?
Sure. In this region, we have a really great and very rich media landscape out there. We have daily newspapers, we have TV stations, very vibrant news talk radio stations. And one of my favorite types of outlet to work with are the local weekly papers. I grew up in Western Sussex County, reading multiple newspapers every day. And those are the ones that I really, really enjoy working with because they have a huge focus on the local level. And we seem a little contradictory to say a huge focus, but those are the types of media outlets that attend every school board meeting. They go to every town council meeting. They'll go to the Rotary and Lions Club meetings and write those up and take photos and really provide information that you cannot get anywhere else. Now, CNN is not going to come to the Millsboro Town Council meeting. The Washington Post is not going to attend the Dover Rotary meeting. So those are really providing a huge public service. And they're the first read for a lot of people. That's the place that a lot of small businesses' customers are going to be turning to look for the latest local information. So that makes them a great opportunity for these nonprofits and small businesses to reach.
And so those, you know, by definition, these local outlets are a lot more accessible than the national and global outlets, but there must be a disconnect, particularly with the organizations you're aiming this book at. And I wonder if you could talk about the misunderstandings that organizations might have about media, even at that local level, or what are some more general disconnects that you're hoping to make some better connections there?
That's a fantastic question, because that's really one of the gaps that I've been tried to bridge in this book. A lot of ordinary people who haven't worked in and around the media before simply don't understand what the media's needs are. They don't understand deadlines, how they work, what they need in terms of visuals, what they need in terms of good stories. So especially these days, with the media world having shrunk quite a bit, there have been a lot of outlets closing, layoffs, and just some outlets, even those hyper-local weekly publications, they have cut back in areas too. So reporters and editors and photographers don't necessarily have the time that they once had to sit down and explore a local issue in great depth. One of the main things that I cover in the book is making sure you have a good story to tell, that you're not just putting information out there. You need to have a good, clear narrative, and that you also need to provide visuals, whether that's photographs or video. In a lot of cases, it's both. Newspapers these days have pretty vibrant video sections on their websites. TV stations run photographs on their sites and do full stories there as well. So you really need to focus on both those things in those areas there.
I guess in terms of how these organizations think about public relations, one thing that comes to mind for me is often I see there's public information officers in many of these organizations. Is that who this book's aimed at? And is there a difference between public information and public relations?
Public information officer, that's a title that I've had when I work for a local school district. It's pretty much interchangeable with any of the other titles out there. Public relations director, marketing director, communications manager, they're all very interchangeable. If you have someone like that on your staff, you know, this book is aimed directly at them. But it's also aimed at people who wear many hats, which is a lot of the staff of your local government agencies or nonprofits or small businesses. In the morning, you may be a communications person sending out a news release. In the afternoon, you might be working on a grant application. The next hour, you're updating the website. And then after that, you're working on a print advertising campaign. So that doesn't leave you a lot of space for creating kind of grand communication strategies. I mean, it would be nice if the world worked like that, but it doesn't always do that. So what I tried to focus on in this book is really the nuts and bolts of how to get things done. The specific actions that you need to take, the things you need to check off on your checklist. One thing that I really want to say, Troy, is that one group of people I really admire in the nonprofit world are the folks who wear dual hats working in communications and development or fundraising. The idea of building relationships with prospective donors and asking people to give you money terrifies me. So the people who competently wear two hats in those realms are absolutely amazing. But it, like I said, it doesn't leave you a lot of time for kind of the big picture strategies.
And I know one of the things that I've seen you doing on LinkedIn and Twitter, I guess, is sharing kind of a weekly, I think it's weekly, announcement of jobs in this space in Delaware, and I expect a little bit of the region. You know, we talked a little bit about how the local media landscape has changed in terms of there being less and less time to do the reporting, the photography, et cetera. Do you have a sense of, you know, what the landscape looks like for jobs in this field at the moment and what's being asked of people? Are these in-person, hybrid, remote jobs?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Biggest thing that I'm seeing is a need for generalists, general communications people who can wear lots of hats within that field there. So if you're a experienced or versatile writer or editor, you know how to do social media, and if you maybe have a little bit of graphic design experience, you are in a good position for your career.
And to the nuts and bolts of what the book tries to provide guidance on, I'm going to start a little negatively. What are some ways that organizations like this tend to go astray when they're trying to, you know, pitch a story to a local newspaper or something like that? What are some mistakes that you have maybe made yourself or have experienced others kind of telling you horror stories about?
I think the biggest mistake that a lot of people make is simply not knowing who their audience is within the media. They take a one-size-fits-all approach to doing an event or sending out a news release. You really have to know your reporters, know your local editors there, know your TV producers, and understand things as basic as the best time to send an email, the best time to hold an event. TV stations, for example, mid-morning to early afternoon is a good time to hold your events because they have to be back at their studio or editing their material to get in the 6 o'clock news in that late afternoon. So if you hold a 4 o'clock event, you may not get on that evening's news. With your local weekly papers, for example, you don't want to send something out or hold an event on their editing or design day, because it's usually an all hands on deck situation there as well. And they may not have people to come to your event. Stepping out a little bit bigger picture, one of the common mistakes that some people make is claiming to be or trying to throw their weight around saying that they're a friend of the publisher or a friend of the owner. That does not impress your average reporter or editor. In a lot of cases, there's a wall up in newsrooms between the advertising side and the newsroom side. That's an area that you need to avoid there. Start accusing them of bias. That's another no-go as well. Most good reporters and good editors are not biased. They don't approach things with political or social preconceptions of what a story is. But that said, there are knowledge gaps, certainly, when a reporter comes to cover a story. So one of the things that I advise in the book is spending time with a reporter, making sure they understand the context. Context is a huge issue that you need to include in your announcements and in your news releases, making sure that people understand the history and the backstory of the issue that you're working on.
And in terms of the context, for an individual story, you need to share context. How important is it for people in these roles to be developing relationships over time with outlets and reporters themselves?
Yeah, it's pretty important. Relationships are a lot of what makes good public relations and good media relations go. That said, it's not the most important thing. Important thing is having a good, solid story to put out there. I could be best friends or next door neighbors with my local weekly editor, and if I send him an idea that just does not work, let's say it's informational rather than a story, it's self-serving or overly promotional, they're not going to run it. So having a good story and understanding all the facets of your story are very important.
And I think one of the things your book talks about is what I would say is sometimes the story that your organization has to tell is not necessarily a good one, or it could be easily misperceived as a bad one. And there's a whole chapter on curveballs and crises, for example. You know, do you have any examples that come to mind from your experience of some of those curveballs that either did go wrong or could have gone wrong, and maybe some of the nuts and bolts approaches that helped you steer it in the right direction?
Sure. That's a fantastic question, because crisis communications is one of those areas that often gets overlooked because it's not staring you right in the face, right? You will have to deal with it eventually. It's a guarantee that whatever organization you're in will eventually have some sort of a crisis to deal with. I've been pretty lucky in my career, Troy, in that none of the organizations or agencies that I've worked for have encountered a full-blown emergency or disaster, but we've come pretty close. And that's really emphasized to me the importance of planning and preparation and training. There's a saying in the military, it goes something like, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in combat. It's the same type of thing when it comes to crisis communications. Your business or your organization can be managing through a problem with extreme effectiveness, but if you're not talking about it and if you're not communicating about it in the right way, no one's going to know or care, and your reputation is going to take a hit. So even an organization as innocuous as a local library can have a crisis if, say, somebody objects to the contents of books in its collection. Planning ahead and developing a good crisis communications plan will help you weather those challenges that will definitely happen.
And a lot of these roles in small organizations, if they're not entry level, they're, you know, not executive level positions. And I wonder, you know, this is a team sport communication. There's not one communication person in an organization. And in fact, sometimes the executive director or managers may be more likely to talk to the press just in the course of their business. How important is it to kind of have them on board for the individual that's in that, quote, communications role? And how do people who aren't the executive go about making that happen in an effective way? Do you have any advice for that?
Yes. Yeah, you absolutely have to have buy-in. You're 100% correct there. You have to have buy-in from the leadership, whether that's your executive director or your board of directors, on the importance of communications. If we're talking about crisis communication, of the importance of planning there, you can't leave it for the last minute. You don't have that. That's something that any member of an organization can start to work on. gradually and slowly making sure that people at all levels of the organization understand the value of communication, the importance of clear and concise messaging, and making sure everyone is on the same page.
I think communicators have been in the limelight a little more during the pandemic or communication period. We had president, governors talking to the public on a daily basis, giving very detailed scientific information, and not always received as intended. I think that's a fair way to put it. And I guess what, for someone who's been in this field, both as a journalist and, working in organizations trying to get the message out, do you think anything's changed in this field in terms of attention or approach in the coming years?
I think we've learned a lot of things about communications coming out of the pandemic. This was a situation, especially early on, where people were at home, not necessarily at work or at school, trying to get through daily life and paying very, very close attention to a lot of the messaging that came out. And I think for a lot of people, it was the first time they realized that, hey, this process can be pretty messy. A lot of things changing from day to day, and that's the work of communications. Things do change very frequently, especially in an evolving situation like a pandemic or like any other crisis. I think one thing that we really learned from this pandemic is the importance of good stories that really go beyond the dominant story of the day or the prevailing narrative. I'm thinking back to those early days. We were all very eager to read and watch about something other than COVID and lockdowns and things like that. It also really taught us in the communications field, it taught people the importance of flexibility. We couldn't invite people into buildings or schools or to visit locations. So remote interviews over Zoom really became common, even for TV stations that wouldn't ordinarily have sent a reporter or videographer to your location. All of a sudden, everybody was good for Zoom because that was the only way you had to talk to people and get them on camera.
And you've mentioned a good story several times. And I wonder, if you could kind of define that from the perspective of, it's not a feel-good story necessarily. It's a good story. What in your mind makes a good story that's going to appeal to media outlets?
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out, Troy. That's a really important distinction. A good story is a story that is effective in telling them, in getting out the message that you want to get out. Yeah, not necessarily a nice to do story, but an important story. The question of what is a story can sometimes get into one of those deep philosophical types of discussions. I'm not a deep philosophical type of guy. To me, a story really requires four things. You need to have some sort of an obstacle or a challenge or a problem to be solved. For a nonprofit, this might be the problem that you're trying to solve for the community or for other people, right? You need to have characters, number two. Those could be you, your clients, your supporters, your constituents. You need to have a journey, some sort of a path to solving your problem. And that would be your work or your programs or initiatives. And then a solution or resolution or even a victory if it's gotten to that point yet. How you solve the problem. That may not always be possible to have, depending on the type of story or the stage that you're in the process, but you can at least signal that you're on the way there. I find that it's often most useful to think about what's not a story, right? You've heard the old line, dog bites man is not news, but man bites dog is news. Good story is not routine. It's not run of the mill. It's not mundane. It's also shouldn't be complicated. It should be pretty simple to understand and definitely should not be boring. You just need to have something that really attracts attention and engages people. When I was a reporter and an editor in Ohio and Maryland and Delaware, a lot of the things that would come to the newsroom were that kind of routine, boring information. So reporters are always on the lookout for things that are new, exciting, interesting, innovative, provocative even. It can be difficult to narrow in on those types of good stories, right? It can be challenging for organizations, leaders especially, to kind of take off the blinders and look past the day-to-day operations and challenges. You get so deep in the weeds, you forget the bigger picture there. But you have to do that in order to really identify a good, strong, compelling story that supports your organization's goals.
And thinking about your book, DIY Public Relations, released on October 4th. What's the story going to look like for that release? And what's the victory look like at stage four? What are you hoping the reception looks like to this evolving story?
I'm hoping the reception is a positive one. I think it will be. I've gotten great feedback so far from people in the industry, in the communications field that I've asked to take a look at it. Great feedback from some small business executives, nonprofit leaders. So I'm really hoping it'll be a positive thing that will benefit a large number of people. So that's the dream. That's the hope.
And if you looked back as you started your career and you had this book, what would you have hoped it would do for someone like you, kind of just starting off in the field?
Well, this is exactly the type of book that I wished I'd had when I started out. You know, I moved into PR public relations after 10 years as a reporter. So I thought I knew how a lot of things worked from the opposite side of the fence. I kind of flipped things around and applied those lessons there. But a lot of the information in this book was gained just through hands-on work and trial and error, the way anybody learns anything. You try something out, you get it right, or you mess it up, and then you learn from that experience and try it again. You know, you're constantly searching for those gems of stories that people love, or iterating your methods and your approaches there.
Well, I know I look forward to diving into the book more and sharing with colleagues. I'm in an organization that kind of fits the bill of your target audience. So looking forward to some lessons learned and looking forward to tracking how this book works out and your next endeavors work out for you. But thanks a lot for taking time with me today, Dan.
Thank you, Troy. Thanks for having me.
To learn more about Dan Shortridge and DIY Public Relations, visit danshortridge.com. For more information on the Institute for Public Administration, visit ipa.udel.edu. Thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to First State Insights and tune in again soon. Take care.